talk now? Can you? Can I still
oh,
can't
shoot.
Hear myself?
We're about to start.
Why don't you switch? Why don't you switch to this one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you switch
we'll
to the switch to this one? We'll end.
The Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I am Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for joining us this week. This is kind of a conversation about what the Church is doing in the world. And we speak with those people who try to make our world more just and more compassionate. And because God is in the world and we believe in the incarnation through Jesus Christ, there's not much that we consider beyond the purview of what's going on in the world. So we tend to talk with people about a range of topics, and we talk with them about a different thing. So this week, we're going to talk a little bit about food and drink. And we're talking about them because food and drink are essential. We're going to talk about it in a variety of different ways. One of the ways we're going to first talk with Mary Flynn, who is the supervisor and clinical research dietitian at hospital in Rhode Island. And we're going to speak with her about good food, feeding people who are hungry through food pantries and things of that nature. And that's a topic that's kind of really important to me because it's important that the people who come to our food pantries get nutritious food. So we're going to speak with her about that. And because it's also the week when it's around St. Patrick's Day, and St. Patrick's Day is a very big celebration for Irish Americans in the United States. We're going to be speaking about with later on the show, Jackie Berglund, who is the CEO and co-founder of a beer company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And their claim to fame is they donate the profits from their beer company to help people get fed through various types of food programs. So that's what we're going to be speaking about this week on Just Love as we kind of are continuing our Lenten celebration. Our celebration, I use the word celebration because it is a time when we do celebrate the fact that that we're getting ready for Easter. We're getting ready for the celebration of the Paschal Mysteries and the Easter Mysteries are the mysteries in which we celebrate Christ crucified and Christ risen from the dead, the renewal of stuff. And, you know, it's getting to be spring-like. And depending on where you are in the country, you're probably getting a earlier or a later taste of spring. Here in the Northeast, we're getting a pretty healthy dose of pre-spring warmth, which is kind of nice, even though we didn't have all that bad a winter. So it's good that we're moving forward into that. So you know what I think we'll do? Why don't we go to our first guest, who is Mary Flynn, the supervisor, the chief research dietitian for the Miriam Hospital, and she's an associate professor of medicine at Brown University in Rhode Island. Mary, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted. I'm delighted you're interested in the topic.
It is great. It is great. So give our listeners, let them know a little bit about yourself. How'd you get to be what you're doing now, what you do? Give us a little of the Cliff Note version of your CV.
Sure. I went to an undergraduate in nutrition, and the only thing I didn't want to do was clinical dietetics. That's the only thing I knew. I knew I liked food. So I did a number of things. I was in the Peace Corps. I was worked for the Rhode Island Seafood Council. I worked in a CAP agency.
Where were you in the Peace Corps?
Ecuador.
Ah.
In the 70s.
Habla un poquito español?
So then when I decided I'd go for my master's degree, and it was there that I learned that I really, really liked research. So I did that at Maryland. I was able to come back to Rhode Island, which was my goal, to come to Northeast. And I started off in basic human nutrition research. I did lipid metabolism. And then that was in the 80s, and that's when people were really becoming interested in using lower-fat diets, which I always loved food. So I looked at it and said,
I love food, too. I eat too much of it most times.
Well, now a lot of dietitians do, but there was a time that mainly, you know, people thought they don't like food, they take things away from us. But But nutrition is classically taught from a nutrient standpoint. And I was always interested in food, and it originally started with...
I do food from a taste standpoint.
Oh, yeah. Well, that too. If it tastes good and it's good for you, that's really a winner. So I became interested in olive oil in the 80s, but it wasn't until the mid-90s, after I finished my PhD, that I realized that I could actually maybe figure out a way to do research in this area. And then about 20 years ago, doing any research in olive oil was terribly frowned upon because people are still very much interested in low-fat diets, but I was really determined I was going to give this a go. So I developed a plant-based olive oil diet that I had up and running by the end of the 90s, and I was doing some
Okay, but I got to get you. But I got to ask you, Mary. So sure. we got all these different foods. We got all these things in the world. So tell me about it. How'd you get obsessed with olive oil?
Oh yeah, well that's and obsessed is the word, Monsignor. If you ask any of my friends or my students, well, in the 80s when I read studies looking at what did they say? That's when people were interested in low fat diets in the U.S. and they were really starting to push them. I read the studies that were out of the Mediterranean countries saying that olive oil was related to higher health, particularly if you had a lot of it. So I thought, that's really intriguing because it's really a fatty food, pure fat. So then in the 90s, you started to see papers being reported showing that women who used a lot of olive oil had much less breast cancer. People who used a lot of olive oil, much less heart disease. So that's what really became intriguing to me. And I felt it had to be part of the diet, partly because one of the problems with a lower-fat diet is you're hungry all the time. So people won't stay with it. So I thought if you put in some fat calories is olive oil, a healthy fat. Remove the animal protein calories because you really don't need them. There's no health benefits from poultry, seafood, and meat. So you remove those, replace them with olive oil. What happens? And what I've shown is initially was people will lose weight better. They like the diet better because they're not hungry. And then it was improving risk factors. It was lowering blood pressure, which is in the literature. And it does many things for your health. It makes your insulin works better. It makes your glucose work come down. So it has all these properties that help decrease risk factors. So then when I did a larger grant that I could look at women with breast cancer, and I was comparing my diet to the low-fat diet recommended by the Cancer Institute at that time. And that diet was similar to Weight Watchers about 10, 15 years ago. And what I found was when the women ate my diet, they started to report, these were all older women, over 60, over 70, they started to report, this is really inexpensive. I can't believe how cheap it is to eat this way. It didn't occur to me. And coincidentally, I was at that point, I started working on the board of the Rhode Island Community Food Bank. I was part of an organization starting at that time called Women Ending Hunger. I was able to work through the food bank and piece together funding to start working in food pantries. My goal in the food pantries was to say, if I developed recipes that follow this plant-based olive oil diet, all I wanted to say was low-income people will use them 2 or 3 dinners a week.
So, Mary, let's go back a little bit. Did I hear you say that there's no nutritional value in meat, in seafood, and fish?
There's no health benefit, no health-promoting values, correct.
What does that mean?
Well, it means, all right, so you have nutrients. So
nutrients are good, right?
Fat and vitamins.
Nutrients are good, aren't they?
Right, but you can get them in many foods.
But so it's not, they're not that they don't have health value. You just think there are other things that are better.
They have these nutrients in them, but what they don't do is promote your health. Health is the absence of chronic diseases, which is found through phytonutrients, which are in plant products. So by eating poultry, seafood, and meat, you are not improving your health. You're not decreasing your risk of chronic disease. There's no reason to eat animal products. You can, but there's no health reason. So my focus is to try to get people to eat less of them and more plant products, which olive oil is one. Olive oil is the juice of an olive. So it's a different focus, but what happens with the low-income population is that meat is more than 50% of their typical grocery budget, a lot of their budget, and it's not giving them any health benefits. So I just wanted to say, if they ate this way, would they decrease their food costs, which they did, but then the other spin-offs were they really improved their diet, and we didn't ask them to do that. We said just, use these recipes, and they all lost weight. And now I'm working on programs where we're showing it will improve the diabetic.
So let's talk about this. So that in other words, you're not saying necessarily that those things are bad for you. You're just saying they don't do extra good stuff for you.
Well, red meat. I think red meat. You can make a case it actually will increase your risk of disease. Red meat,
okay.
Processed meat, poultry, and seafood are probably neutral. My concern is,
but Mary, so to our listeners out there, When, like, you know, we're in an age where let's pretend we're a political campaign because we don't have to be bound by facts. So I can say, yeah, but when the whole world says it's better to eat chicken and you should eat chicken and fish and put those in your diet and it's better for you, so the whole world's wrong?
Well, no, I don't think anyone says that, actually. That's a marketing thing. There's no science to say that. It is better to substitute poultry for meat, but you don't need the poultry. And the problem, my problem
is... But you need something.
Well, you're going to get your poultry, you're going to get all your protein. You get all vegans who eat no animal products, that's what a vegan is. They get all the protein they need.
Now, now here's an interesting question. And this is just, you know, market people out there. I've had three people in the past week tell me, just tell me. So this is not a controlled sample. Just tell me. Say, boy, doesn't Bill Clinton look unhealthy since he's become a vegan?
Yeah. He does. But see, he did. So my thing is, if you add olive oil, he's adding no fat. So he's not eating fat. Vegan diets can be very low in fat. There's a range of vegan diets.
Okay.
I agree with that. I thought that. I saw a picture of him and said, boy, this guy does not look well. But if he would add extra virgin olive oil to his diet, he would do well.
Okay, I got it. So now we're speaking with Mary Flynn, supervisor and chief research dietitian for the Miriam Hospital and associate professor of medicine at Brown University in Rhode Island, and a self-admitted obsessive with olive oil. So Mary, now kind of tell us, like, give us, you know, for us ordinary folk. So if we kind of want to eat this diet and be healthy, whatever, give us a typical thing we would eat on a day. Give us a day diet.
All right. So you have, all right, so I'll give you a day of mine. Can I just make a point on the protein? Because I just want to get that in on the animal protein. One of the problems people don't realize with any protein is our need for protein is actually much smaller than what many people think it is. It's 8/10 of a gram.
I won't eat that protein bar anymore.
Okay, so but the problem is extra protein that you consume is stored as fat. That's what people miss. So eating poultry and seafood, big slabs of it, you're just putting fat on your body. And there are more and more studies showing that high-protein diets is a typical diet, like an American diet. It's the protein that's related to body weight and fat, not the fat in it. So
yeah, Mary, I don't want to get depressed.
Point.
Enough of that. Tell me what I should eat.
All right, so I'll tell you the typical days. All right, typical day, you could have something like, you could have breakfast cereal, hard or cold, with a few tablespoons of walnuts or almonds, some fruit in that, and some fruit with that. Okay. So the almonds will, so that's basically a diet with
Do you put milk in it?
You can add milk if you want to.
Okay.
I don't think people have to be complete vegans. And my thing is, I'll say to people, try this for 2 or 3 days a week.
Okay, so for breakfast, we got cereal and milk.
We have cereal with nuts. We have to add nuts. Now, the nuts are important because they add healthy micronutrients, but they also add fat. You have to have a healthy fat at every meal. So then your lunch could be something like, I'll say to people, at least 2 servings of vegetables. So that could be a salad, that could be a soup. But that vegetable is paired with olive oil, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, and then a few servings of starch. So you could have a sandwich that's two ounces of bread, which is 2 slices of bread. You could cook up vegetables in olive oil, make a bruschetta. You could cook up vegetables in olive oil, make a soup, add some starch to that. Then you go to dinner, and dinner is where you can really be creative because it's, again, it's I always say 2 tablespoons of olive oil. Every tablespoon of olive oil I pair with a cup of vegetables. So you're having 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 cups of vegetables, and then 3 or 4 ounces dry weight of starch. You have a big bulky meal. You are not hungry, and that's what people tell me all the time. I am not hungry, and I'm losing weight, and I'm improving my risk factors.
Okay, so I think we got lunch is a little confusing to me. So what are you supposed to have?
Okay,
have a sandwich. Right, you're supposed to have vegetables.
Sandwich. You can have a sandwich, or you can have like I'm having today. I'm having a big salad that I put 2 tablespoons of olive oil on. I put some cheese on it. I do use cheese, and then I have a nice ciabatta roll with it, a 2 ounce roll with it. So I have the 2 ounce roll, which is my starch. I have my cheese. I have my 2 tablespoons of olive oil, and I have my big veggie salad. So that is about 500-600 calories, which is perfectly fine for me.
Okay, so that's okay. That sounds pretty good. And now for dinner, you told me again vegetables with the olive oil,
and some starch. So pasta, rice, potatoes, quinoa, rice, whatever you want there.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. And
and the other thing is, it's very easy. That's the other thing. It's very easy. It's very quick. Meals take less than 15 minutes. It's faster than going out to eat. It's certainly cheaper than going out to eat.
Hey, that sounds great. That sounds like wonderful. So now let's go to the food bank, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about your work with the food bank in the sense that does the food bank give healthy food?
They do. We were very lucky. I came on the food bank 2005, I think, and by 2006 we went through a transition, and we were able. By 2007, we had this fantastic director, Andrew Schiff, who was extremely instrumental in changing over what we distribute for food. So he gives the core foods for my diet. It's vegetables. As a matter of fact, my program, they now teach from the Rhode Island Community Food Bank. They go out into the community. They go to the food pantries. They go to the high-rise elderly sites. They go to schools. They go all over the state and teach this program, teach people to cook this way. Our recipes are on the website. But he is very adamant. I tried for 2 years on the board to get rid of soda. As soon as he came in, soda's gone. They don't buy snack foods. They don't buy dessert food. They buy healthy food. It's meal-related food that then goes out to the food pantry.
So what about the cost of it? Is the cost of it more expensive or less expensive?
No. That's less expensive. If you look at if you're someone who buys meat, so look at your groceries.
Yeah, but most food pantries don't give out meat.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. For the food pantry doesn't cost more? No, it does not cost more. It does not cost more. And we do food drives. We do targeted donations, and we ask for specific things. My hospital has been wonderful, and I'm really hooked into the olive oil world now. So I get olive oil donated from places like California Olive Ranch. I work with people in Australia. They donate olive oil. Some of it we pay for. Some of it's donated, but it's a mix. But it's telling people how to eat in a way that will decrease their food insecurity and decrease their body weight.
Now, one of the things I noticed in what you've written, that the vegetables that people should eat, they don't have to be fresh.
That's correct. That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up. Okay, so what that gets into is, when I started in the food pantries, I was trying to work with what is available, shelf-stable type food. And I know everyone thinks fresh is great, and that's true. And I'm all for seasonal, fresh vegetables, and I have a big garden in my yard, and I go to farmers markets. But what I don't like people doing is buying fresh out of season. When you look at retail fresh out of season compared to frozen vegetables, the vitamin and mineral content is the same. The USDA has done these studies. But what the frozen and canned vegetables have are more of these phytonutrients that I mentioned earlier, which will improve your health. So if you're using frozen produce, you're actually getting more of the disease-fighting phytonutrients. So that is a good thing. They also, you can get them on sale. You can keep more in your house. From one of my clients, they have to come by bus. So to buy all this stuff at once and bring it home is easier than, you know, constantly going for fresh produce. It's cleaner. I mean, there are a lot of advantages to using frozen produce. And cooked up into olive oil, very quick, tastes delicious.
So here's what I kind of think when it comes to eating healthy, and whether it's kind of people going to a food pantry or just kind of us ordinary folk, it seems to me there are like three things that people are trying to play off. First of all, do you have the availability of the good stuff, the stuff you mm-hmm. should be eating? Secondly, how about the cost? How much does it cost? And the third issue is taste. And it seems to me that those are the kind of the three factors that kind of go into a person's kind of decision as to what they're going to eat. Now, maybe I'm not right or something. Are there other things that you would see, or have I missed those things?
No, you get them all, because when I teach my students my basic nutrition course, the first chapter has this really big section on how I eat, what we eat. I always say it comes down to taste, cost, convenience, which is just what you said.
Okay.
If you like it, it's taste is the major driver.
Right. So it seems to me that when you talk about kind of canned vegetables and you talk about olive oil, I mean, in any store, you can get canned vegetables and you get olive oil. So that's not a big deal. I mean, that's easy. And you kind of said to us that basically the cost isn't all that prohibitive. And I guess, you know, it certainly is intuitive to me, because, and I'll just share with you something. When we did our food pantries in New York, we tried to do fresh produce. And for a while, we had relationships with some of the farmers markets and places like that. And then when the prices kind of went through the roof, we no longer could do that, because we just couldn't afford to use farmers markets for that produce. But you're telling me, don't bother with that. I mean, you're not opposed to it, but you don't have to do it, and especially be careful of it out of season. And so you can do both frozen and you can do canned vegetables, right?
Yeah. Canned, I think, people have more problem with, because they are kind of mushy. But I personally love canned peas. But I love frozen ones. I love fresh ones. They're the only food I can go across all foods. But, yeah, frozen produce. It is nothing wrong with it. And as I say, I think there are so many advantages to it. And that's what our food pantry does that also. They have a couple of farmers, several farms throughout the state. And they do get the fresh produce in. But, you know, we go through this trying to get the lettuce out, trying to get the produce out. It's perishable. And
yep.
so you're spending a lot of money for something that might get there and look kind of awful, and who's going to take it? So you can offer it when it's in season and if you have it, but I don't consider it a focus for me. I don't buy stuff out of season. I mean, I'll start eating asparagus soon. That'll be like a month of asparagus. That's the end of asparagus. So I think, and the other, when you do that also, it's kind of fun. Like, you're looking forward to fresh tomatoes. You're looking forward to fresh asparagus. Whereas if you have asparagus in January, where's the fun? You know, and they don't even taste that good.
Yeah, but there are some of us who don't even know when the season is. So, I mean, we just think if it's on the shelf. It's...
With the internet now, that's not hard.
Yeah, but that means I got to look it up.
Oh, that's true. Well, you know, it really
I mean, you think this research bit is something we people should do. I mean, we don't. We just want to go to the store, and if it's there, we assume it's fresh. At least if it hasn't turned brown.
Well, you can follow the prices.
I'm kidding you, man. I know what you're saying. But now let's deal with the kind of the big 800-pound gorilla, taste. Is this the fact that we kind of, you know, grow up and have been marketed to that like we need red meat and that's what we really think a good solid meal is, and so our tastes have developed based upon how we've been bombarded with media and advertising?
Well, what we like is the fat. So if you had a really lean piece of meat that was, you know, baked to death, you're not going to like that. But what you like is the juiciness. You, as a human being, we love fat. Our mouths love fat. It's a feel that we love. So when there's no fat in the food, that's when people will eat more, is one thing. But it is marketing. I always say, if I were king of the forest, I said I would eliminate marketing of food. That's it. No more, no print, no media, nothing. It's just you don't have any marketing. And that's what drives us. You're right. Like this whole beef industry. The beef has an enormously powerful industry, the USDA. So why doesn't the USDA say we don't need meat? If you look at the science, you don't need it for health. I will be argued against this by many dietitians, but I'm talking about health as an absence of chronic disease. Yeah, it has things in it that make you grow, but the whole world doesn't eat beef and they're all growing. So it's not, but you can make a case that what is in meat, and it's not even the fat, it's not the saturated fat, it's the amino acid composition, is what will make your health worse. So I say to patients, you have to give up meat. Can you eat it less? Can you have it once a week? Can you have it in a restaurant where they get better quality than have it at home? Can you switch over, make some changes? You know, you don't have to give up chicken, but could you eat a lot less with a lot more vegetables and olive oil? But it is marketing. You're right. That's just what it is. And without ads, why would you buy a lot of food?
Okay, so here's my final question, and this is a make it or break it. Where in your approach to health and nutrition does chocolate cake fit?
Well, you know, that's a very good question.
I'm
a personal lover of chocolate. So what I say to patients is you don't need to give up desserts, but can you rethink desserts? My thinking is if you really
I want to rethink desserts, only chocolate.
That's fine. So twice a month, can you go out and get for lunch the best chocolate cake you can find and have a piece of it? That's much better than bringing the whole chocolate cake home so it's there haunting
Come
you
on.
And saying, you know, you want
Mary,
to eat
Mary, I'm going to negotiate it. How about once a week?
That's fine. That's fine. And what I'm saying is you make it your lunch. So you don't need, with having dessert for lunch. But so you have dessert for lunch and you get rid of your desire. It's an occasion also. So it isn't, it gets into that mindless eating, which I don't like all these great sayings of things. But if you're going out for chocolate cake, you can think of the best place who has it. It's a lovely occasion. You sit down, you have it with, you know, coffee, tea, glass of wine, whatever. That's the occasion. But if you bring, you know, frozen chocolate cake home and, you know, or from a bad bakery and you constantly whack away at it, no, that's not a good thing.
Hey, Mary, thank you so much. I think this has been so, so helpful. Before I let you go, can you give our listeners a website, a place where they can go to learn about it?
I could.
Sure.
Sure. Two things. There's two websites. Well, actually, I have a website because I have a program through food pantries now that, with low-income diabetics that my medical students are teaching, and that website is med, M-E-D, then food, F-O-O-D, diet.com. So it's medfooddiet.com. That's one. And then at the Rhode Island Community Food Bank, if you go under their programs, you'll see, we called it Raising the Bar in Nutrition. You can find it there. But my website will have recipes you can use. They're really easy. It has a whole section on the recipes we're using, and it has the cost of them. Great. And it has, it's done for diabetics, so it'll have calories and carbohydrate also.
Wonderful. Hey, Mary Flynn, thanks so much for taking
Welcome
your time
on,
with it. It was great to have you on. Mary's the supervisor, the chief research dietitian, and the aficionado of olive oil, and... She gets paid for being an associate professor of medicine at Brown University and is doing a great job in kind of educating people and people who come to food banks about how to eat more healthy. So, Mary, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for the interest.
Great. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more beneficial. You know, I didn't have the nerve, Tom, to ask Mary, where's beer fit in? Because when we come back in a few minutes in the last segment of our show, we're going to be speaking about beer and beer being used to make profits and beer being used to then help people eat with Jacqueline Berglund, who is the co-founder, the CEO of Finnegan's Beer Company in Minneapolis. But right now we're going to take a break. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Can you hear me? Or
no.
Can you hear me?
In the first 3 minutes, there was such static.
Oh, really? Was there?
I couldn't tell whether it was in the microphone or I couldn't tell whether it was in the...
Try it now. Ah, there we go.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Love God. Love your neighbor. Love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us. And we're speaking about food this week, nutritional value. And a little bit later, we're going to be speaking about beer as kind of St. Patrick's Day is just right around the corner with somebody who founded a beer company in Minneapolis and is dedicating the proceeds of that company to support food programs. So we're going to speak with Jacqueline Berglund in just a little bit later. Tom, what's in the news?
You know, Monsignor, there's been a lot of stuff going on
Tom,
this week.
I wouldn't have asked
That's why I'm going to tell you. I would say it was funny. It was, you mentioned earlier a little bit about Lent, and we have a little bit of sadness, actually, Monsignor. I don't know. Last weekend, you probably had seen where on Friday, March 4th, down in Yemen, gunmen actually broke into a nursing home there that was started by Mother Teresa of Calcutta. and they killed 16 people, four of whom were missionaries of charity from Mother Teresa's order. It's extremely sad. You know, Yemen's been going about a year-old civil war, and the civil war has been going on between the Saudi-backed Yemeni government there. There's then a group called the Houthi Fighters, who control the capital in Yemen. They're backed by Iran. And added to that very toxic mix, we also have the Islamic State and state in Al-Qaeda involved. So it's been there's been a lot of violence that's been going on there. But this particular act really, I think, moved the conscience of the world because, you know, they attacked a nursing home. They wound up killing the residents of the nursing home and these nuns. And it was really terrible.
Was there any rationale for it?
The rationale has not been found yet. No one has actually claimed responsibility. But in the civil war in Yemen so far, and this is a country that has a population of about 24 million, over 3,000 civilian casualties has wound up taking place. 5,000 have been injured. So I just think it's really a power struggle in that part of the world, Monsignor. And the Pope, basically Pope Francis, wound up praying for them. And he wound up praying that these people, he called them martyrs, and he called them martyrs of charity. And he said they were not only killed by the people who pulled the trigger on them, but he actually said they were also killed by indifference. He called this part of the globalization of indifference, and he prayed that Mother Teresa would accompany those who were killed to heaven, her daughters, the martyrs of love, and intercede on their behalf.
You know, Tom, let me take an opportunity to kind of just say a few words about this. It's incredibly sad because in our world and in our age, it seems to me that there is a growing intolerance based upon one's religion. And I think we just have to say that in the current time, there is an incredible amount of persecution, violence, hate being directed towards Christians in various parts of the world. And, you know, particularly in those countries where Christians are a minority, oftentimes where the majority is Islamic. And I think we just have to recognize that that is going on in the world. We can't deny that there is religious persecution, and a lot of it directed towards Christians. And as soon as I say that, I want to add the sentences by saying that and trying to deal with it and raising awareness. That also means that we have to say that of the more than a billion Muslims in the world, that they are not proposing, they're not persecuting everybody. It is a small, but unfortunately, very strong group of deviant Muslims who are perpetuating this violence. But we can't say they're not, but it's a deviant form of Islam. And then the response can't be from countries in which there are Christian majorities, like the United States or other places. Our response can't be then to persecute Muslims because of the actions of some deviant Muslims. And that's where it goes back. Now, again, I don't mean to equate, and I will not equate kind of violent acts of killing and martyrdom with inappropriate and disedifying rhetorical language. But at the same time, that type of rhetorical language, that type of hate language is also not acceptable either. I don't mean to equivocate, you know, saying things negative with actually killing someone. They're not the same. But we can't respond by drawing broad pictures and broad brushes of things. And so I think, you know, we have to be a little bit realistic. And I think, you know, if people say, hey, wait a minute, well, you're only speaking up for Christians. You know, what about everything else in the world? Well, wait a minute. We're going to speak up for when Christians are persecuted. And I mean, I know I personally have spoken up when other religions have been persecuted, and there are different situations in which there is anti-Jewish sentiment, anti-Jewish actions. We have to speak up for that. When there are anti-Muslim, we have to speak up for that. But we can't pretend that there isn't a lot of persecution going on in the world now, and that we have to kind of name it and raise it up, because that's not what it means. And you know, the United Nations Charter in 1948 of Human Rights recognizes the right to worship, the right to practice worship as a critical part. And I think we have to say, you know, our American government, which prides itself on religious liberty. I mean, we have permitted us to go along in certain places where, because of certain strategic foreign policy initiatives, to deal with countries that have really not been very tolerant towards Christians, wouldn't even let people, Christians, worship publicly in those places. And I know our world isn't perfect. We're not going to change things overnight, but we got to recognize the fact that by fostering religious understanding, by religious reconciliation, that we foster the dignity of human person. And we just have to be kind of voices to make sure that that happens. And so let's take a break now, Tom, and we'll come back and we'll get into the upcoming St. Patrick's Day when we speak about Finnegan's Brewery in Minneapolis and the use of the profits of beer to help people be fed. So join us when we come back on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Well, St. Patrick's Day is coming up soon, and Irish Americans have been a big part of this country. A lot of migration here. And in fact, I'm told that the celebration of St. Patrick's Day in certain parts of the United States maybe even is bigger than the celebration of St. Patrick's Day in Ireland itself. And we're going to be speaking now with Jackie Berglund, who is the CEO and the co-founder of Finnegan's Beer Company in Minneapolis. And the claim to fame is that Finnegan's donates all its profits to fund food for those who are in need. Jackie, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, you born in Minneapolis?
Yes, I'm born in the Twin Cities area, yep.
Okay, well, that is great. So, tell us, I mean, everybody associates, good or bad, with Irish, with beer with St. Patrick's Day, all of those type of things. So tell us, how did you get involved in starting a beer company?
So it was back 16 years ago, actually. We've been at this 16 years. And really what it was about having a sustainable business model, having an idea where we could sell something and be economically sustainable, and then donate the profits back to doing something good. And at the time, I was a director of marketing for a group of Irish pubs. And it was my dear friend that owned the pubs, and we came up with this crazy idea. What if we sold beer in our pubs, and then we took the profits and we helped those in need? And, you know, very much in line with the Irish of generosity and hospitality and those kinds of things, the beer fit right in that profile.
And was that about the time, or you must know the history, when the whole notion of microbreweries and things like that began to really take off?
You know, this was actually in front of that here in the Midwest. So this was in like 1998, 99, okay, where we had this idea. But we really thought what happened with wine a decade earlier, where people started to become more sophisticated about wine and demanded better wines, we thought that was going to happen with beer. So when I started this company, we had 6 breweries in Minnesota, and we now have 111.
111 breweries? 111 breweries?
Yeah. And when I started this company 16 years ago, there were 6.
Wow. So how do you, I mean, I think you're like the fifth largest or something in Minnesota.
Yeah, well, in the last year, we've shifted back a little bit because we don't have a tap room yet. The laws all changed. They kind of liberated what breweries can do, and now they can sell pints at their own establishment. And so, actually, we're in the process of building our own brewery and tap room, and in the next 2 years, we'll be able to compete with all the other breweries that are now serving pints at their own establishment.
Ah, so I mean, how much beer do you sell?
So we are the 10th largest Minnesota beer brand, okay, and we're close to doing 10,000 barrels of beer this year. And so there's 31 gallons in a barrel. If you do the math, it's a fair chunk of beer.
All right. So, I mean, let me ask this way. So if you went to a baseball game, how many baseball games could you provide with beer for the year?
Okay, so we do have our beer at Target Field, and we do sell our beer there. I don't know their sales numbers, to be honest with you, how much beer that would be.
Okay, but that's so you sell 10,000 barrels of beer a year.
Yeah, wow. We do.
And who do you sell it to?
So we sell it in bars and restaurants and liquor stores, and we have a broad swath of supporters. A lot of people drink our beer because it's really good beer. And a lot of people drink our beer because they really care about the community and they like where the profits go. So there's a lot of different reasons that people drink Finnegan's.
Oh, that is great. That is wonderful. And right now you're kind of in that area around Minnesota. You're not yet nationally distributing it, correct?
Yeah, we have a regional footprint here in the Midwest. So we're in 5 states: Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa.
Okay, that's a pretty good district that you're selling to, and I assume the people there like the beer.
Yeah, they do. And our giving program, I just wanted to mention that because it kind of fits in the Midwest. Our profits go to purchasing produce from local growers, and then that produce goes to local food shelves. So being the agricultural Midwest, our giving model works very well here. As you can imagine, there's a lot of farmers, and we pay market rates for the food, and then we get really healthy food to those in need.
So tell us a little bit about that piece of the pie. And I understand the philanthropic place that you wanted to do a business that you could kind of earn a living from, but the profits would go to kind of helping the community. So give us a little bit about how it works.
How it works. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. So in each state where we sell our beer, we partner with a food bank. And so there's one food bank in every state that we work with that we track our profits, and we write them one check. Here's all the money. Here's the profits in your area. And they are able to extrapolate that by beer market so that it's truly scalable local giving. So what happens is for all the beer we sell up in northern Minnesota, let's say Duluth, those profits in that market go to purchase produce from a farm in Duluth, and that goes to a food shelf in Duluth. And the same in southern Minnesota, and the same in the Twin Cities. And so we're able to scale it truly at a very local level in supporting those communities and those local growers and getting that fresh produce to those food shelves in those communities.
We're speaking with Jackie Berglund, who is the CEO and co-founder of Finnegan's Beer Company, which is a beer company in Minnesota and in that area, which has breweries, which is the 10th largest now in Minnesota. And they use their profits to help buy healthy produce for individuals. So, Jackie, if I get that right, is you kind of partner with a food bank in each state, and they actually do kind of the purchasing of the food and the distribution of it into those local areas.
Exactly. So, because we're a real small company, we've got 5 people covering 5 states. So we really need everybody to do what's in their wheelhouse. So we really rely heavily on our food banks, and they have that network and that partnership, and we pay them the money, we fund the programs, and they kind of do the heavy lifting out there in the community to make sure that everything is implemented properly.
You know, Jackie, I just want to talk a little bit about this for a second, because your model, I think, is a model that is very effective and very efficient and very caring. And here's why I say that is because I work at Catholic Charities in New York, and periodically people come to me who are in business and they say, you know, we really want to help you. We want to help kids to read. And I'll say to them, oh, I said, you know, there's this really great after-school tutoring program that deals with kids who are falling behind, and really could you help? And the person will say, oh, no, I want to do it myself. And we're going to set up an organization that's going to do that. And, you know, I'll say to them again, you know, but you're going to have to set up a lot of infrastructure, and it's already here. No, I want to do it my way. And what my frustration is sometimes is that there's a lot of good going on in the world, and we need to build on each other's strengths in order to do that good, and maybe just reduce a little bit our own kind of egos.
Right.
And do the partnership, because the food banks know how to buy food. They know how to distribute it. You know how to make beer and make profit. So it seems
right,
to me.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. You're preaching to the choir on this one.
Yeah.
And I am all about everybody doing what they're good at. Do what's in your wheelhouse. Partner with people who are good at the things that you need to get done, you know, to make your program work. But I am all about not reinventing wheels. It's expensive. It's inefficient. There's no good reason to do that when you can do strategic partnerships where everybody wins, right?
Yeah, and again, I'll tell you another story, which is much more positive. A group of lawyers and finance people invited me probably about 3 or 4 years ago, and they wanted to do good. They wanted to raise money. They wanted to help people. And actually, it was around the area of food that they wanted to do that. And, you know, the first meeting, they talked about setting up a foundation. They talked about all of those things they wanted to do. And I said, great, you could do that. But, you know, I can tell you that, you know, Catholic Charities partners with the New York Food Bank. We work with about 30 different food pantries. We kind of work with volunteers. We work with staff, etc. And I said, you know, we need food. We need people who can do different things in those areas. And they said, then why should we set up something different? We can just use this network to do the good that we want to do. So I think there are people who realize what you are saying is a very efficient and a very caring way to do things.
Thank you. I think so too, and I've learned a lot. Actually, my sister works at Catholic Charities here in the Twin Cities.
Ah, okay. Ah, great.
So she and I actually share philosophies on this stuff, and I know she's in the housing and emergency services, but we do real similar work in different ways. It's interesting.
So tell us, what do you, you know, maybe if you had something you wanted to do different, you'd do it different, or something you'd like to grow into in the next year or two, what are your plans for the future?
So the next thing we're doing, which I'm super excited about, is we're building this brewery, but it's going to be a brewtel. So it's going to be a brewery, Finnegan's Brewery, with 160 hotel rooms. So you actually go stay at the brewery. And we're going to have an event space. And then I'm starting another company called the Finnovation Lab. And this is really my new big passion, is we're going to help incubate and support other social businesses who have business models similar to Finnegan's that want to do business and do good. And we want to help grow those companies and support those companies. And so we're going to have an 11,000 square foot facility that's going to have various types of social businesses in it, and we're going to put together an investment loan fund to help financially get these guys started and then help to grow more social businesses, because I think the more businesses that we have like this, the more healthy communities we're going to have.
When are you going to get that up and running? How soon is that one on your agenda?
It's going to open December 2017 if everything goes on schedule. So I've got 2 years. I'm right now doing the fundraising and kind of building out the model and the infrastructure, and this facility that we're building is actually 6 blocks from our new stadium, our new football stadium in Minneapolis. So it's got to open before the Super Bowl, which is February 4th, 2018, here in Minneapolis.
I like deadlines. It kind of gets you up and running, and
it sure does.
You know, and you know what I like about your approach is, I mean, basically, I'm not a big fan. I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of nonprofit organizations getting heavily into enterprises and entrepreneurial stuff, because I don't think it's our expertise. And I just look, you know, periodically at some of the business magazines or the business media, and, you know, what is it? You could tell me better. Of every 100 businesses that start in the United States, 90 fail within the first year or so.
Yeah, it's tough. The statistics are challenging for sure.
Right. So, you know, we try to help people, and, you know, they're just different skills. So I say let businesses kind of be as entrepreneurial as they can, and then let's partner to see how we can help people to do good, because you know how to run a business. And, you know, if you weren't making any money on your beer, you couldn't help anybody.
Right, it wouldn't work at all, to your point, exactly. And that's like, I'm really glad our food bank friends are focusing on what they're doing, because, you know, that then I can plug in and we can have this great partnership. So I agree. I'm really a believer in everybody doing what they're good at and they're passionate about. You know, I think passion's a big, important piece in our work lives. And if people are passionate about providing services and the programs of feeding the hungry and implementing those programs, then that's what they should be focused on and that's what they should be doing, right? And I think innovation is a great big thing in any for-profit or nonprofit realm. I think we always need to be innovating and looking for more efficient and effective ways to do things. But to your point, everybody needs to focus on what they're good at.
So let me tell you a little bit of my own kind of anecdotal story, since you're busy building a brew hotel or whatever you're calling it. So a number of years ago, I was visiting somebody, it was an elderly person who was sick. And in upstate New York, near the Finger Lakes of New York State. So long and short of it, wound up staying in this castle there by almost accident. Somebody canceled the reservation. And so we went up there. We got a couple of rooms in that. And we're staying there. So we get there and they have these big sinks, I guess, in the hallway. It's an old building. And they have these water spigots. And they have glasses there. So I go over, it was a long drive to get a glass of water. So I do the spigot, and it's not water, it's white wine. It's white wine. And I'm saying, what's going on here? Well, it was an old speakeasy, and the pipes came from where they made the wine in the bed. And as part of their thing, on every floor, there was this used basin with a spigot where you could just pour yourself glasses of white wine.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
So what did I do immediately? I called the restaurant, the hotel, and said, "Push back our reservation an hour and a half. We got some business up here before we come down to the restaurant." So I'm just giving you an idea for your for your brew hotel.
Okay, I love that idea, and there has been some discussion about having tap handles in every room. You know,
I think it's the Geneva. the Genovese Hotel in the Finger Lakes, so you can check it out for yourself. But anyway.
Okay, I'm going to look that one up. That sounds fantastic.
Hey, Mary, Jackie, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate what you're doing. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thanks so much, and I wish you a very happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you. Jackie Berglund, the CEO, co-founder of Finnegan's Beer Company in Minneapolis. So, Tom, I think we're prepared for St. Patrick's Day next week. I think so.
For sure. For Germans here. I mean, and certainly I think we have to try and get our hands on if we can, see if we can get Jackie to send us out some Finnegan's.
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't ask Mary in the first part of the show where beer fit into her thing, because she probably would have told us no. It's probably not got good health stuff, all of that stuff. So we won't tell Mary.
Well, she might have wanted you to put 2 tablespoons of olive oil into the beer, possibly.
Or she could have had me go out maybe once a week and substitute beer for lunch.
That's a good point. That's a good point, Monsieur.
Chocolate cake one day, beer the next day.
And beer the next, yeah.
I think that's not a bad thing to do. Tom, do you have any traditions for St. Patrick's Day?
You know, we do, Monsieur. I usually go up to my folks, and then generally, you know, we'll go, my father will make a corned beef, and we'll have that as a family. But the funny thing is, my mother will say, now my father's Irish-American, my mom's parents were from Ireland, and my grandmother and grandfather never saw corned beef in Ireland, ever. Corned beef is an American phenomenon, American-Irish, not Irish-Irish.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They would eat ham, mostly, ham and lamb. So corned beef was, I think, something that the American-Irish kind of undertook here. But that's a big tradition in our house.
Well, you know, I'll tell you another little piece of the pie is that there's a tradition that Ireland didn't have good cuisine, but that's all changed recently. There's
yeah.
a lot of good cuisine in Ireland. So, listen, I think we did well. We talked about how businesses can help people. We talked about, you know, St. Patrick's Day. We talked about nutrition and how our food pantries can even be more nutritious. So I just want to thank you all for joining us on Just Love this week. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.